Blog Talk Radio.
Transformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. The World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future. And to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, I am looking forward to the four-day weekend that just lies just ahead. I'm going to be able to take off Thursday and Friday, and
yeah.
I'm very much looking forward to it. I've been burning the candle at both ends at work and could use a little break, and this is going
to
be
great. Nice to have some, you know, 4 days for the fourth, huh? But I got to tell you, I am not looking forward to the four-day weekend because I'm taking tomorrow off. Which is why we're doing the
5 day weekend for Phil.
5 day awesome. Weekend, which is why we're doing the show tonight. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be up in the mountains, and although there is an internet connection in the cabin we're going to be staying, I'm not entirely sure how reliable it is. So I thought it'd be a good idea for us to just be on the safe side and do the show tonight. So I appreciate your flexibility and everyone who's joining us live this evening. Thanks for your flexibility for being with us on a Tuesday evening. An evening on which we've done a number of programs in the past. Has it ever been our regular night? I don't think it has.
Never been our regular night, but this is hardly the first time. We've had series where we went all week, you know, having a show like every night, didn't we, Phil? I mean, haven't we done that?
We have done that. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And then we've had Sunday night was our regular night for a while, for a good while. I don't think that there's been a single night of the week that we haven't done a show.
There is no night that we haven't done at least a couple or three, more than once, right? And
right.
At least Sunday, Wednesday, and Thursday have all been our regular night, haven't they? Wasn't Thursday our regular night for a while? I believe it was.
Well, it's been a pickup night more than once, too, because, reason or another, if there was some sort of technical glitch, we that completely killed the show on Wednesday, we'd come back and do it on Thursday often. That's happened more than once too. So we've been all over the map with it, and we appreciate our listeners finding us on whatever night that we managed to get it together. But it's usually Wednesday. But
when we do get away from them, they find us on iTunes, or they find us on the archives at Blog Talk Radio. And we appreciate you listening however you're listening. I personally listen to the show sometime the following week via the podcast app on my iPhone. I always listen to the shows to make sure that there's nothing I need to go back and edit out that you said, Stephen, you know, because you know how you get carried away. But.
I am a loose cannon. You have to, you know. You got to take the bad with the good, though. You know, I mean, it's. I realize that I can really blast the show to heck, but it's all. You know, the awesomeness comes along with that. So you know,
that's right. Well, it keeps it exciting.
No deal. Deal with
people
it.
Are listening with bated breath, going, "What's he going to say next? Now, what's he going to say?" Like, yeah, it's just, you can't be seen that. Yeah, it's that kind of thing. But where was I going with that? Oh, anyway, it's great to have this opportunity, the fact that we're on an unusual night, and the fact that this is 4th of July week, Independence Day week, to revisit a topic that we've talked about on the program before, a blog post that I have been reposting both at The Speculist and now at The World Transformed, and I believe it's been on Better All the Time too, and probably it's been on L2SI, so every blog I've done, not counting Transparency Revolution over the last 10 years, I've put this post on it, The Declaration of Singularity. But I think this is the first time, check me if I'm wrong, Stephen, first time we've dedicated an entire show to it. I think maybe in the past we've talked about it, but also had other topics in addition to that. Like last year we talked about it, but we also did a movie review of the, can't think of the name of it now, Prometheus, prequel to Aliens.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's worthy of an entire show. It's a little bit of a provocative thing. What you've done, Phil, is you've taken something that's revered. You know, there's lots of people that hold this, you know, it's almost scripture to a lot of people. You know what I'm saying? The Declaration of Independence, and you've altered it, and a lot of, you know, there have been people, you've been criticized for that. And
I think
let me defend you by saying that this is not us, playing down the importance of the Declaration of Independence or in any way belittling it.
Thank you. That's right.
I don't believe that was your intention at all, was it, Phil?
Never remotely. And in fact, it's interesting that the criticism that I've gotten for it in the past has been primarily in that direction. And this year we're going to deal with some criticism that's come from another direction. So that's kind of interesting. But the criticism I've received for it in the past has all been about, you know, there's nothing wrong with the Declaration of Independence. Do you really think this is an improvement? No, I don't think it's an improvement. I'm not trying to fix the Declaration of Independence. I'm not trying to update the Declaration of Independence. And we'll get to the critiques I've gotten on some of our favorite Facebook sites here tonight and talk about those. Those actually come from another place. But actually, before we jump into the Declaration of Singularity, I want to hit on something closely related, and it has to do with the 4th of July. Stephen, question for you.
Okay.
That you know of, do you have any ancestors who participated in the American Revolution?
I'm actually descended, Phil. We've done the lineage. George Washington is a great 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 uncle of mine.
Wow.
I'm descended directly from George Washington's sister, who
wow.
is a great 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 grandmother of mine. So yeah, I should say yes.
You're kind of tied into the revolution. Now, was her yeah. Was she married? Was her husband or son actually involved in the revolution? You know, other than the fact that her brother was the, kind of a close tie in there, I would say. Yeah.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. Since she is a direct ancestor of mine, I should know more about her. But yeah, no, I don't know.
Well, that's very cool, and in fact, that totally beats mine. Okay, but this is exciting because you know if you're a Bauermaster, anyone listening who is also a Bauermaster or a Bauermeister, we know that we're all probably connected to each other, and most of us know that we seem to in this country originate from Ohio, although originally before that we came from Germany, and there's a town in Ohio called Bowersville that a lot of us seem to have some connection to. But I've never known the full story. Well, my sister in Kansas City, my sister Ellen, who's a frequent listener to this program, has been researching this for some time, and she's actually finally untied the knot here and figured it all out. And it turns out that we are directly descended from Peter Bauermaster, who was the person that he was the first resident of Bowersville, Ohio, and he is the person that the town was named after. And he was my great, 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 great grandfather. His father was a man named Johann Gottfried Bauermeister. And he came over to North America in 1778 and he fought in the American Revolution. So this is a connection to U.S. history that we never knew we had. We always assumed we came over much later than that. On my mom's side, her grandfather came over from the Netherlands. So we always figured that we were fairly recent additions. We didn't know that we went all the way back to the Revolution. So that was pretty exciting. And my sister was
looking back and running your family tree like that is that there's not one answer to that question, is there? I'm sure you have recent arrivals in your family tree. You've got, you know, people from way back, you know, you probably got some American Indian in there. I mean, it's, we Americans have an interesting lineage, I think.
It always gets mixed. Well, and the thing is, you know, the number of ancestors doubles with every generation. So by the time you say great, 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 my, you know, Johann Gottfried is my, you know, 5X great grandfather. How many of those do I have actually? How many in that cohort? If I've got 2 grandparents, I've got 4 great grandparents, 16 great greats, 32 triple greats, 64 quadruple greats. So he's one of 128 ancestors that I have in that cohort. So you know what? He's not the only one probably who fought in the Revolution, but he's the one with the same last name that
he's
we were
the
able
one
to
that you know about. He's the one. That,
and it wasn't even the same last name because starting with his son Peter, they changed it to Bauermeister, but he was Bauermeister anyway. We know he was his father and that we're descended. But here's where the story gets kind of interesting. Yes, he fought in the Revolution. In fact, he was a Hessian mercenary who fought for the British in the Revolution. So, Stephen, you descended from George Washington's sister, and I descended from a Hessian mercenary. Our families were actually on opposite sides of the American Revolution.
I was gonna make a joke about it, asking whether it was a Hessian. You know, Bauermeister is a German name. And I was wondering about that. So that's interesting.
He was in fact a Hessian. And now here's where the story. I can't decide if it gets better or worse. Okay.
All right.
But 5,000 Hessians came over. All right. Do you know how many went back to Germany?
Probably very few.
2,000 went back to Germany. Several were casualties, but the remainder of the majority of that 3,000 deserters. And I have to admit that my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, Johann Gottfried Bauermeister, was not only fighting on the British side, but he was a deserter. So you tell me, Stephen, is that better or worse, actually?
I think it's better. It puts you here, for example, Phil. You are an American citizen because...
That's true.
Because a Hessian a long time ago deserted the German mercenary forces and joined up on the American side, but...
But anyway, took that advantage away from the British. And may I say in all modesty, it's why the Americans won. Okay, it's because my grandpa, he deserted. But anyway, so, you know, it just goes to show you, be careful what you ask for. You know, my sister was all excited when she learned that we had an ancestor in the Revolution, because now she could join the DAR if she wanted to, right? And... oops, turns out he's a Hessian, so probably not. And even if they took people on the British side, I doubt they take deserters. So, DAR for us.
Sometimes it's best not to look too far back, you know, with researching family trees. We've got some characters in my background, I can tell you that. So, yeah, I'm not just... You know, you noticed I mentioned my connection with George Washington. There's so much I have not mentioned, and so.
Well, we can hit the Civil War, but you know, I don't even want to know. All I can figure is that probably some Ohio copperhead, in my line, went down and fought for the South and then deserted, right? But the one bit of solace I take from this is that Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, was actually a Confederate soldier for a brief period of time. And got a real feel for soldiering and deserted, right? And he's the reason that we know who Samuel Clemens is, right? Because obviously if he had stayed in the Confederate Army, he would have been kind of persona non grata after the war, and he probably wouldn't have become the man we know today. It also gave him kind of a perspective on the whole thing. Interesting that obviously if he had deserted from the Union side, we would, you know, have certainly never heard of him. He probably would have been executed. So, you know, there's there's at least that one good example, other than my grandfather, of somebody deserting from a major American conflict. I'm grasping at straws. What can I tell you? So there it is. So that's,
it's okay, Phil. I think no less of you. You know,
oh, so. Thank you. Thank you. And that's coming from a direct descendant of George Washington's sister. So I feel I feel highly validated. Okay. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to read through the Declaration of Singularity. Before we do, I want to talk a little bit about what it is for, what it is intended to do, because I think that it gets misunderstood. Stephen, you mentioned that we get this criticism of, like, I'm trying to fix the Declaration of Independence, or I'm trying to update it, or something like that. This, you know, not the intention at all. I want to read a comment that was over on Singularity Network, actually, that Dan Gilman wrote. He wrote, I actually do like this. The contrast is good. He's talking about the Declaration of Singularity. Though I will admit, maybe it's my dyslexia, but that was a hard read even with the bold font going on. When I first went into it, I was reading it as jibber-jabber. I appreciate the work of it, though. I'm hesitant to really go with it in the sense of going, this, oh yes, this, and waving it about like I just found Heraclion. Well, you know, everything I write, I think people should do that with, so I think he's missing the boat there. But then he says, well, I'm not in anyone... Yeah. Well, I'm not in any one camp. I do lean a bit towards Jacques Fresco's speeches. Not sure how much of outmoded concepts of building a new society I want defining singularity. In that, I'm not sure some things, even fairly profound for its time, things like the Declaration of Independence, can be patched to really fit with what's coming down the line. Okay, so that's a great statement. Could we, you know, can we actually patch the Declaration of Independence to be a valid statement of what's coming with the singularity? And my answer to that is, of course not. And that's really not the intent here. To me, what's interesting is simply to draw out the parallels and to speak a little bit metaphorically. What I like about the Declaration of Independence, among many other things, is that it states in a very straightforward way, the world has worked this way up to this point, and here's how the world needs to work from now on. And to me, I think that is a fundamental concept that underpins both singularitarianism and transhumanism. I think that those ideas are dependent on turning away from one mode of existence and turning towards another mode of existence. So I'm using the Declaration of Independence metaphorically. And sometimes I think amongst our cohort, amongst our peeps here in the accelerating change world, metaphor has a hard time. I think we deal with some very literal-minded people here, don't we?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And, what we are attempting to do here is the same thing that, the writer of the Declaration of Independence was attempting to do, appeal to the sense of justice of those that were outside of the direct conflict. Okay, yeah, obviously you had a conflict between Great Britain and the colonies, then the colonies, and it was an appeal to the sense of justice, primarily of continental Europe, right?
Yes.
How the colonies were being mistreated and how this was not right and all that. Here, what you're attempting to do is just to appeal to those who could potentially be won over that, the way the world has worked up till now, there's been some injustice in it. And it doesn't have to be that way going forward. And so I think it's the parallel is great, and we're not certainly not belittling the original Declaration at all. This is this is just an attempt to draw out a metaphor or parallels, and I think it's good.
Yeah, I think you're right on the money. The audience here is anyone in particular who will read this and resonate with any of it. Anybody who says, yeah, you know what, the world really shouldn't work that way, that the civilization that we're currently in is laying this on us or is insisting that the world has to work this way, and in fact it doesn't. So we're talking about a metaphorical revolution, not a literal one. So over on Zero State, we kind of ran into the same thing with Kaiser Betancourt. He wrote, I agree with both points. I should clarify both points. I had written, like the founding fathers, transhumanists and singularitarians believe that we are subject to an oppressive regime with no legitimate claim on our lives or our futures. Has the time come to declare our independence from a world of pain and scarcity? And he says, I agree with both points completely, but I fail to see any reason they're connected. The current political malfeasance isn't better or worse than ones which have happened in the past, and it is not a damn thing to do with technology. The fact that they're using current methods to be oppressive is quite the same as ever before. Likewise, being a futurist or a transhumanist may imply that we're striving towards some particular goal, which is highly debatable anyway, but it does not imply that anything about our path is reactive based on the current state of affairs. I totally disagree with that. I think that that what we call the human imperative defines all human progress as being reactive to the current state of affairs. I think that that all evolution is reactive to the current state of affairs. So I have to disagree with that point, but there's more I disagree with here, so let's push on. He says, furthermore, the term singularity has been utterly misused here, as the singularity has nothing to do with either. The singularity will have tremendous effect on the future, but until we get there, there's no way to account for it, and it is not the point of transhumanism, which more or less ignores that eventuality, specifically because we can't know what to do about it, and waiting to see would render us impotent. I don't know. What do you think about that, Stephen? Transhumanists and the singularity. I guess if we're being very rigid in our categories, the point there would be that if you're a transhumanist, you're not interested in the singularity, and if you are, then you're actually a singularitarian, I think is where he's coming from. So I'm going to actually cede that point, unless
okay.
I'm, you know, okay, fair enough.
I would say that if you were to draw, do a Venn diagram showing here are transhumanists and here are singularitarians, don't you think there'd be quite a bit of overlap? It would not be two separate circles. I would argue that most of the circles would encompass each other.
Yeah, in fact, see, for me, I don't really see myself as a singularitarian only because I don't care for the term much. I tend to think of myself as a transhumanist. Actually, I just tend to think of myself as a humanist. I think PJ would endorse me on this, and I think that the singularity comes along in line with that. But that's okay. You know what? We could argue about the categories and what they mean all night. It's fine. I shouldn't have mentioned transhumanists if it confuses the point. Anyway, he goes on to write, I see this post/event as the worst of corporate jargon mashing mixed with an overly enthusiastic and vastly misinformed mind. Now, fortunately, I've worked in marketing for the past 20 years, so I know a compliment when I hear one. I want to take issue with one final point that he makes after I said, hey, these are great comments. We'll try to get to them tonight. And in fact, here we've spent way more time than we should have probably on them. He writes, it seems that what's meant there is a subtype of futurist/transhumanist which have stirred in libertarian philosophy. Now, here's where I think we can provide a little education. Although I am vastly uninformed on these matters, misinformed on these matters, and I'm likely to just mash jargon here in some corporate way, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that
we should rename our show Corporate Jargon Mashing.
Yes, Corporate Jargon Mashing about the future. Yes, by two vastly misinformed, well, one vastly misinformed and one moderately misinformed host. You get to be moderately misinformed. If I'm not mistaken, really, don't transhumanism and singularitarianism trace their roots to the 90s to extropianism? Wasn't that really kind of the original accelerating change movement that gave birth to all the rest of this? And wasn't that primarily founded by libertarians? The idea that libertarianism is some add-on to H+ or singularitarian type thinking, I think is just wrong. I think that historically,
well, we had a guest on the show a while back, Phil, that said that he described himself as a techno progressive, and said that really in order to be involved with these sort of topics and to care about this sort of stuff, you really have to be progressive. You have to be on the left side of the political spectrum.
And there are plenty who are. I don't disagree with that, sure. But
that's obviously not true, because here I am very much interested in these topics, and I'm not progressive. I would consider myself a techno-libertarian, and I think that's pretty much where, a lot of this, stuff grew out of it. And of course, there's people from across the political spectrum that care about these ideas. And
I think so. I agree.
Yeah.
And in fact, I won't even, although my views are not, they don't line up well with what progressives would say, I refuse to relinquish that term because I actually believe in progress. So I consider myself a progressive. But actually, I want to wind it back a little bit before even that, because I think it's completely valid that you can be a progressive, a techno-progressive or a techno-libertarian. I think both strains have had a lot to do with kind of the founding of this movement and keeping this movement alive. But when did the Declaration of Independence become some like radical libertarian document? You know, I mean, am I missing something there? Is that suddenly like crazy libertarianism? I thought that, at least from an American perspective, the entire political spectrum would look at the Declaration of Independence and go, yeah, well, we all agree with that anyway, right? I mean, did it become like political or ideological outside of the mainstream at some point and I missed it?
Well, you know, it could very well be outside of it could very well come across that way to maybe this one individual, but I would bet that people across the political spectrum, at least publicly, embrace the Declaration of Independence. You're not going to find like a caucus of congressmen who think this is a wild and woolly idea that should probably be suppressed. Everyone, it's like waving the flag. Everyone does that. You know, it's not something that I think is held by one party or another.
And that's why I think it works well for this analogy. It works well for this metaphor because my thinking was, well, here's something that we all like and agree on and is familiar to us. So now let's use its language to talk about something that's a little outside of our experience, a little bit new, and show that there are parallels, which is really all that the Declaration of Singularity is about. It's really not a political manifesto at all, because, you know, I don't really do those, Stephen, as you know, that's not really my thing. Great question from Ken in the chat room. How long will the left-right dichotomy survive into the future? I think we'll always have it, or we'll have some version of it. This is my answer, my take. Stephen, I'll let you respond to this too. But it will have a very different flavor. It actually has a very different flavor today than it did even a few years ago, and it will a few years from now, I think. Certainly, as we close in on the singularity, I think our categories get so confused that people will be rapidly switching sides and trying to redefine things. But ultimately, you'll have two groups. One that is primarily interested in the good of the collective and the good of the individual through the collective, and the other that's interested in the good of the individual and the good of the collective through the individual. I think that's kind of the breakdown. I would agree
completely with that. It's and you know, it might you might call it statism on one side and individual liberty on the other. That of course those terms would tend to have some judgmental aspect to them, but that's how I feel about it. The tendency on one side would be to say, you know, we want to use the power of the state to uplift the individual, and then the other side would say, no, the individual needs to have as much freedom as possible in order to uplift us all. I tend to come down on the second half of it, and right now I suppose that would put me to the right of center, but I think that those labels will exactly what you said, Phil. I think those labels will be mixed and changed and interspersed to the point that, you know, but for example, liberalism used to mean a very very different thing from what it means now, and.
And we'll mean something else in a few years. Yeah. Absolutely, and conservatism,
you know,
same thing.
I can't find any fault with most of the arguments that would be classified as classic liberalism. It's because again, it has a lot to do with rights of the individual. So anyway,
it'll be interesting to see what happens. I take a good deal of solace from the fact that you hardly hear anybody say. And I think very few people believe, on the one hand, well, to hell with the larger group of people, or on the other hand, well, to hell with the individual. It comes down to this, like how you apportion responsibility. Certainly, there have been societies that have said one or the other in the past, but I think within the American context, nobody ever says completely to hell with the individual or completely to hell with the common good. And the truth the truth tends to lie somewhere in between. But here we are, almost halfway into the show, and we haven't even gotten to the Declaration of Singularity yet. So maybe we should just zip into this thing, because we've got a lot of ground to cover here, Stephen.
Yeah.
So once again, we're speaking metaphorically. So I start out talking about in Congress. There won't really be a Congress, for anyone who's reading this metaphor literally, some unspecified date in the future. That part's true. The unanimous declaration of a new post-human civilization. I don't think that the whole civilization will get together and make a declaration. So, okay, I'm off the whether it's literal or not. Okay, so let's talk about the language of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all, and I change this to sentient beings of human level or greater intelligence, are created equal. Now, right off, we run into an interesting conundrum here, because even on a different post I put up over on Singularity Network, I think it was last week or earlier this week, about a Kurzweil debunking, it actually, I don't know if you followed that thread, but it deteriorated or evolved into this whole discussion about IQ and whether IQ should be the determining factor in who rules the world, right? So right off the bat, there might be some who would take issue with the idea that that all intelligences are created equal. What do you think, Stephen? This egalitarianism, does it survive into a post this world kind of idea, or should it? Do we need it to?
We need it to. We certainly need it to. And you know, here's the thing that the guys that were writing this knew. We're not equally gifted, and we don't have equal outcomes in life. You know,
right?
Some people are brilliant. Some people are born beautiful, and they're beautiful all their lives. Some people are physically powerful, and some people have none of those gifts. And some people are lucky, and some people are in life, and some people are unlucky. Some people are born with just huge ambition, and get out there and work hard, and then others. Never developed that within themselves. So, you know, so are we equal? Well, what we're saying is that, I think what the founders were talking about is an equality of worth within the sight of their creator. I think that that's what they were talking about. And it was, and basically what they were arguing for is an equality of opportunity. In other words, the state shouldn't get into business of allotting to some people, Here's your lot in life, and here's what you can do. You can accomplish this because of your birth. You're in this station, and so you can become president one day. But you know, these people over here, no, you're in a different guild or class or whatever. You know, they're saying no, we're not going to do that anymore. We're all created equal now. We don't have a class structure like we've seen in the past, and that's the way it ought to be. And I hope that survives as, we enter a time when there could very well be people of vastly different gifts, some of which will be artificial or engineered or whatever, that the egalitarianism of the original Declaration survives all that, and that, you know, people are allowed to pursue their dreams to the best of their abilities, whatever those abilities are. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. Well, I think the... One of the interesting comments in that thread was somebody said, yeah, I think IQ should be the determining factor. It should decide who has clout in this society. And does this make me an elitist? Yes, it does. And so I always like it when somebody I like it when somebody owns being an elitist, because I think we all are, just in different ways. I'm personally uncomfortable with giving all the cards to any one group. Based on a particular characteristic, just because it's like, well, what does intelligence include? And you know, there's this whole discussion going on in this thread about, well, does intelligence include, you know, emotional intelligence? Does it include compassion? Because if you've got like super smart, super nice beings, okay, that are driving our course. Well, I feel one way about that than if they're just kind of super smart. If they're super smart, super geeky, kind of socially awkward, maybe super nerdy, I feel less comfortable about that. I'll come right out and admit it that that if you give all the power to those who are better able to solve math problems, but maybe not so well equipped to solve personal problems, or not so well equipped to communicate with others or to empathize with others, I think you've got a significant problem there. So the idea of saying, well, once you reach a certain level of intelligence, we're just going to, under law, say we're all equal. To me, that makes sense. That was a good idea in the Declaration of Independence, and I think it's a good idea transmuted going into a post-human society. But ultimately, we are going to be at the mercy, potentially, of a greater than human intelligence. I mean, if a real explosion occurs, right? If something just takes off, we have to hope it's nice, right? Because it will be so much faster than us, and potentially so much more powerful than us, that it will become obvious that it really is a legal fiction that we're all created equal. It will have a huge advantage over us. And what I'm hoping is that it will have read my Declaration of Singularity and go, oh yeah, I should treat them all as equals.
My hope is that it's not one or a small group of individuals, but that it's a large number of people are able to make the leap. I think that the more people that are able to make this leap within a short time of each other, the better for society. If you have a potential one bad actor among these people, then those who are not could defend the rest of humanity against them. So. Just a thought.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. I'm gonna skip down quite a bit because we'll run out of time otherwise. In the framing of the Declaration of Singularity, in addition to endowed by their creator, I added some options. If it's not our creator, it's the designer of the simulation in which we find ourselves. If it's not that, it's just a kind of a universe intrinsic self-improving evolutionary / developmental process. Whatever language you're comfortable with. Now, some people would probably think I should have done the strike through on the creator altogether. That's fine. They're entitled to their opinion. And others think that maybe I should have just left that alone and it was fine the way it was written. That's why I've got three options there. Okay, so whatever your preference, I'm kind of a big tent singularitarian, all right? Whatever you feel about this, it's okay with me. Just don't be a jerk, I think, is kind of my bottom line on that. So I'm going to skip all this, the rest of this paragraph, because basically it's just laying out the fact that we believe in self-determination, that we don't think that someone else should get to set our course for us, and that really our destiny is in our own hands. Interesting that Thomas Jefferson had to write a lot of language to set that idea out. I think today most people would agree with that, and you don't have to set that out. I don't think we have to spend a lot of time on it. So I'm going to move on to the second paragraph. I'm going to skip the rest of that paragraph. And the next part says, such has been the patient sufferance of these beings, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former, instead of system of government, civilization. The history of the present, and instead of King of Great Britain, we're going to say post-industrial age, I'm just referring to the age that we currently live in, is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the prevention of the further evolution of these beings. To prove this, let the facts be submitted to a candid world. So let's talk about what's happening. This is our list of grievances, okay? And this is the one section of the Declaration of Singularity that's an absolute rewrite from the Declaration of Independence, because the Declaration of Independence obviously talks about King George, quartering soldiers in people's homes, and all the specific grievances that the colonies had against.
Speaking of jerk, I mean, there's an example of some things he did were really jerky.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, things like cost him his colonies. Yeah. So, what is the current world doing that is jerky, right? What is the current world doing that we disapprove of? Well, item one, okay? In the face of unrelenting progress, this civilization has continued to hearken back to, quote, natural limitations of development, which must never be challenged. Now, I think it's wonderful that in the past few years, we see this idea increasingly questioned. But this has been something that we've kind of dealt with all our lives. There's this tension between what's natural and what's artificial or made up or man-made. And somehow the idea that the latter category is always somehow suspicious, somehow suspect, and the former category is good. When we had Aurelian Carpathia on a few weeks ago and we were talking about simuality, this was the objection I was trying to capture that people are going to make about simuality, right? That it's just not this, like there's something magic or pure about nature that hasn't been touched by humanity. As soon as we get our hands on something or as soon as we make something, it somehow stains it. It somehow corrupts it. And I think that's exactly wrong. I think that's almost exactly backwards, that we live in the world that we've created or that we have built out of, you know, the world that we were given. And that's as much our reality as the reality that we were born into. And
fails to recognize that we ourselves are natural. You know, I mean, we're not separate from nature. We are a product of it. And I do believe we have a special duty to this world because of our intelligence to be good stewards of it. But to act as though we somehow stain the natural world as if we're not a part of it is naive.
That's the word.
So.
Exactly. It's naive. It fails to recognize the fact that we're a bunch of atoms, right? I mean, you know, if you're a pure naturalist, what are we if not nature? We are nature. We are the cutting edge of nature, I think. And related to that, it has set artificial and arbitrary limits as to duration of lifespan. Now, it doesn't enforce those limits. Currently, those limits are enforced by our biology, by the fact that we can't go beyond them anyway. But we've also got a social stigma that says there's a point beyond which you simply can't go, that it's wrong to even try to go past this. And we've got a whole kind of medical establishment, a whole kind of medical science community that philosophically doesn't allow for the idea of going past those limits, right? So we've got the natural limits, which we could try to overcome, but it's hard to work on overcoming those natural limits because we've got these imposed cultural limits. And I think, you know, those are the ones that we've got to declare our independence to if we're ever going to make progress in the other category.
You know, we've seen some progress, Phil. I mean, you know, when you were a much younger person, you probably remember a time when non-traditional college students were very unusual. You know, people that were going to school going to college, let's say, after the age of 40 or 50. And in fact, probably I forget when the case came out, but there was, you know, a lot of colleges had rules about, you know, what's the upper age limit of a undergraduate, that kind of thing. And of course, you know, and it was, the idea was there's a certain, you know, life has a certain, you know, pattern to it. You know, you know, you're a child and you go to elementary school, then high school. And then, you know, if you're fortunate, you get to go to college, and if not, you're going to work. And then, you know, you work a certain number of years and you retire, you sit in your rocking chair and you die. And you can't really get too far outside of that. We've broken those categories down, and we do things out of order now, and that's just fine. You know, a retirement can turn into a sabbatical that the person can go back to work or go back to school.
Right.
And I think that is that's a preparation for a time when we have indefinite lifespan.
I think that's a great point. I think that you're right, Stephen. In redefining careers and in redefining kind of life plans, we're starting to chip away at these still kind of sacredly held ideas about, well, you get your 70 years, you get your 80 years, whatever they are, But to ask for more than that is somehow selfish or somehow unnatural or something like that. Well, it's no more unnatural than starting your PhD at 65, if that's what
right.
you want to do. And there was a time when people might have said, oh, no, why would anyone? That's crazy. No one would do that. But now I think if you hear that, generally people are like, well, so what? Whatever. They're blasé about it, or they admire that idea. And I
yeah.
think that's the corner we're going to turn, that people will either be blasé about the fact that somebody is living to be 150 or 160 years old, or they'll say, yeah, good for him. You know, he's got a lot of life in him, and as long as he's happy and healthy, why not? Why wouldn't we live as long as we can live, right? Live to see it, if you will. Okay, so I got several of these, and I'm afraid I skipped one, so I'm going to go back to it because I think this is huge. Our civilization that we currently live in has promoted and enforced harmful and prejudicial distinctions between human and non-human intelligence. And you know where we see this? This is also a restatement of the natural versus artificial. It's the idea that that we're somehow cheating when we're using computer technology, when we're using information technology. I know that that's as alien an idea to you, Stephen, as it can be, because you're the guy who talks about the fact that you count Google, right, as part of your own memory, right? That's like your external storage mechanism, right?
And, you know, I was kidding about it somewhat. I was saying it somewhat tongue-in-cheek back when I first said it years ago when it was, you know, when I had to sit at a computer and log in and use Google or the internet as a whole. But you know, with the advent of smartphones, and then who knows what the future holds? You know, when the technology is even more intimate to us, then it very much is part of the way we operate. It is our memory. We don't, you know, we depend on the internet and networks to such an extent to do our work, to have fun, that it really does become a part of us. And there shouldn't
Absolutely.
Be a distinction. I think to the extent that there is a distinction, I think it limits the full richness of what we can accomplish with these networks.
Yeah, well, the only distinction that should exist is the one that's actually there. When there are real barriers to us being able to access information or to make use of that intelligence or to work collaboratively with it, then yes, there's a distinction. But to say there are some limits, or we shouldn't depend too much on it, or we shouldn't go too deeply down that hole, that's just completely wrong. It completely misses the point. And the point is that we developed all that technology to help us think, you know, to improve our own intelligence and to move us towards our own goals. Now, when that technology takes on intelligence of its own, starts setting its own goals, then we've got a really interesting situation. The relationship between our intelligence and that intelligence at that point, that becomes more complicated. But if we're already at this kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Adversarial relationship between the two, we're starting in the wrong place with that. Whereas if we start the way you're starting, Stephen, by saying, well, Google's kind of my external memory source, right? And when you know, Stephen 2.0 online is doing everything he can to help you, you know, run your life better. You guys are going to be pretty simpatico, right? You're not going to have a problem with an quote unquote artificial intelligent agent that's working towards the same goals you are. And I actually think this is one of the things that moves us in the direction of the kind of singularity we want to have, which is if we view our machine intelligence infrastructure as an extension of our own intelligence. And when we start
he'll be my mate from another substrate. Anyway.
There you go. Very good. Very good. That's right. And when we see them as us, right, as our
yeah.
children or our brothers or our, you know, siblings, however you want to look at it, our best
our
buds.
Our best friends.
Yeah. You know, that just makes a lot more sense than viewing them suspiciously as potential competitors or potential threats or something that's taking away from the natural order, which I think is just the wrong way to look at it. Okay, how about this one? It has enforced meaningless distinctions between labor and leisure. There is this notion, I think, that's really going to rapidly disappear anyway because the whole idea of employment is so badly threatened right now, that there's serious things that you have to do in order to earn your living, And then there's like fun, entertaining things that you do to make your
that
life
are
richer.
Completely non-productive. Yeah.
Right. Yes.
The truth of the matter is, it doesn't have to be that way, does it? I mean, so our fun can be productive, and our work can be fun, and all intertwined together. It's I found that that's a little bit the case. It's become more of the case with me in the last year or so than ever before in my life. I might be sitting there on the couch with surrounded by my family and I'm sort of halfway watching a TV show while working on something doing a little work as well. You know, got the laptop open in front of me. It's there's not a big distinction. I can only do work at a certain location. The location thing is completely broken down.
Right.
When you're all digital, it matters not at all where you are in the world. Location is completely gone. And so then, maybe there's just times of the day that you work. No, not necessarily.
All of those are totally artificial constructs. They all had to do with how to make a factory work most efficiently.
Yeah, exactly.
None of us work in factories.
We're a little bit far beyond that at this point.
Yeah. The idea that you need to put in 16 hours or 8 hours or whatever it is, 10 hours, that there's a certain amount of time that you have to put in order to make something productive happen is wrong. You know, the thing that has to happen is whatever the productive thing you're trying to make happen. Yeah, the idea that it has to happen in a certain place, the idea that it has to happen at a certain time, or, that you have to be wearing a suit, or, whatever, right, is just all not true. It has nothing to do with the actual good outcome, the productive outcome that the work is focused on. And, yeah, if it can be fun, if people can enjoy working on it, if the productive outcome for whatever business endeavor or government or whatever it is endeavor that you're working on is also something that is personally satisfying to you, that is something that you feel creatively engaged in, so much the better, right? There's not only nothing wrong with that, it's kind of the right direction to go, especially since we may end up with a world where the machines do all the actual productive work, and we're only going to be left with the self-actualizing stuff. So we really need to start valuing that a lot more than we currently do, because that may be our careers in the decades to come.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's see. We're running out of time, huh? How about this? It has equipped despotic governments and enterprises to restrict the means of production and self-expression to a limited few. And, we've broken through that so entirely over the last couple of decades, but especially the last decade, that it's hardly even worth mentioning anymore. The one area where this is still kind of restrained, I guess, is around copyright law and intellectual property law. Those still thwart people in some ways, but on the other hand, they have to in some ways because they're still the whole business, the whole matter of some people need to make their livelihood from selling intellectual property, and you can't just give everything away now. So we'll hit an inflection point on that eventually, I suppose.
Yeah. Agreed.
And I'm sorry, was there something else you wanted to say about that one? I kind of cut you off there.
Well, I think that you're exactly right. With the advent of, of blogging, of podcasting, some of who are doing vidcasting and everything else, anyone can be expressive. If you have something to say, say it. If it's well said and well thought out, you'll no doubt be able to command an audience. If not, then you won't. And it's probably the freest and best marketplace of ideas in the history of the world that we've seen arise in the last few years, thanks to the internet.
Absolutely. Well, and that final point is all about the same thing. It has promoted the creation of artificial boundaries between creative minds. Nothing has come down more thoroughly, I think, than those barriers in the age of the internet and the age of the smartphone. That whatever limits to that, either businesses through their long distance fees or governments through their censorship or their attempts to remain closed, to keep societies closed, you know, whatever attempts
even,
have been
even
put
the
in place.
Even language barriers, Bill, you know, I mean, the language barriers
exactly.
are coming down, too. So, I mean, it's all coming down, and that's awesome. Now
yeah.
You got, you have
go
people
ahead.
Throughout the world communicating and doing productive things with one another all over the world. So
yeah, if people have something to share with each other, if they have something interesting they can do together, if they have something creative they can do together or some good outcome that they can produce together, the barrier to them finding each other, the barriers to them finding each other and actually working together are lower than they have ever been. I think they're going to get considerably lower even than they are now, but they've come way down. And that is that's just great news. For us as a species. You know, as I read through this list, when did I first do this? 6-7 years ago anyway. I feel like we've come a lot closer on these things being realized even over a half a decade than I would have guessed. It could be that we need to update this list because some of these things are kind of taking care of themselves, although that is sort of the point. Because once again, I don't think there will be a Congress that gets together and declares the beginning of the new civilization. It'd be kind of cool if there was, but you know, it usually doesn't happen that way. There was no declaration of.
Actually, I would be disturbed if there were. I think this yeah. you know this is a grassroots kind of thing, Phil, that is going to bubble up from below rather than handed down from on high.
Well, imagine, you know, the Australopithecines got together and said and signed a declaration saying we're not going to be chimps, right? We're this other
anymore.
Thing, right?
Yeah, we're done with that. And exactly.
Yeah, those guys can go ahead and be chimps, but we're going to be something else. That's right. That's right. And so that's where the declaration proceeds. I'm not going to read it, but we know if you've not read the Declaration of Independence, do yourself a favor and read it. Where we go next is we say, okay, we're not going to put up with this. As we've established, we get to determine our own fate. And what we're going to say is we renounce any, you know, in the case of the Declaration of Independence, government, or in our case, civilization, that imposes these limits upon us, that we're not going to accept those. And I think transhumanism and singularitarianism are all about looking at those limitations and saying, no, we simply will not accept those limitations any longer, and we're going to move beyond those limitations. And that, in a nutshell, is what I was trying to get at with the Declaration of Singularity. And in case we're unclear, we'll probably revisit it again in about a year. Okay.
Exactly.
What's our music this evening, Stephen?
Our music this evening is Galveston by Ezra Thomas.
Is that the old Glen Campbell Galveston or a different Galveston?
It's a different one.
Oh, okay.
And Ezra Thomas has been on Fast Forward Radio, and I don't think this is his first time we've played him on the World Transformed. But,
his premiere on the World Transformed.
He's an old friend of ours. We've played him several times.
All right, Ezra Thomas singing Galveston. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Happy Fourth to you and your family. To everyone listening, thanks for being part of the World Transformed. We'll be back on Wednesday night. Next week, the regular time, and until next time, live to see it.
Gathered you up in a thousand days, from 17 till old and gray, throwing shells on the Galveston Bay, your crying eyes and your heart full of grace. Gathered you up.
Broken and calling your name. I guess.